Hello, everybody. You're live with Patricia Corey, known to most of you as the author of The Syrian Revelations. I'd like to welcome you to the show, Beyond the Matrix, a program for people who dare to think outside the box of convention. I'd like to thank BBS Radio for always providing the platform for people to bring through wisdom, messages, and information that humankind need now, especially when we can't get it from mainstream media. I have an outstanding guest tonight with me, Stanton Friedman. He is the best-known scientific ufologist in North America and probably the world. As a nuclear physicist, he has worked on classified fission and fusion nuclear propulsion systems for space exploration for companies like General Electric. As a ufologist, he has lectured at more than 600 colleges in 50 states, 9 provinces, and 18 countries. He is co-author of the Roswell book, Crash at Corona, and has appeared on TV documentaries on the History Channel and Sci-Fi Channel. So I'm really thrilled to have him with us today. Hello, Stan.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you. I was just going to say, it's a beautiful day here in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada.
Great. And, you know, I'm in Amsterdam, so it's just amazing that we managed to link up and do this show. So I'm delighted. I thank you so much for being with us tonight. And I have so many things to talk to you about that I don't really know where to start. What attracted me to you was that your new book, Captured, is the story of Betty and Barney Hill's UFO experience. And I would like to talk about that as well as everything else that you've discovered, but I realize we've only got an hour, so we'll do our best.
Okay.
Particularly interesting to me about this book is the fact that many, many years ago, I was in Boston on business, and I met Benjamin Simon, who was the psychiatrist who brought Betty and Barney Hill into hypnosis in order to get the story of their abduction. So the fact that you are talking about this is very exciting, and the fact that your book talks quite at length about the hypnosis experience for Betty and Bill. So can you give us an overview of what this book is really talking about?
Well, it's a new approach to the story of Betty and Barney Hill. Everybody's heard of the story, and an awful lot of people read The Interrupted Journey, John G. Fuller's world bestseller, really, back in 1966. But Fuller only dealt with part of the data that was available. In other words, what's different here, there's a couple of things. The big thing is that Kathleen, who's Betty's niece, had all the tapes, transcribed them all, and gave a much more rounded picture of what went on in all those sessions, not just one view of each question. Dr. Simon was kind of sneaky, isn't the right word, but he was clever in how he handled things. He often asked almost the same question, but in a different context, to see how much the answers would change. And what's special about Dr. Simon is not that he knew anything about flying saucers, because he didn't, but that his specialty was extracting memories of traumatic experiences from people who'd obviously been affected by them. In his case, literally thousands of World War II veterans who had serious, I'll call it post-traumatic stress syndrome. They didn't call it that then. It was shell shock war veterans, but... And so he worked out a technique that worked, very deep hypnosis, and carefully extracting what the person knew, what they felt at the time, inducing amnesia after each session. It's kind of amazing how sometimes people think it was only one session and this story came out whole. Well, Betty and Barney each were hypnotized separately for months, weekly sessions, and with amnesia induced at the end of each session, so neither one knew what the other one was saying in the sessions, and the sessions were in a soundproof room, I better add that. And so one of the things that, the noisy negativists, as I call them when I'm being polite, they try to say, all this UFO abduction stuff, it's just the hypnotist pushing on to the so-called abductee, his view of what must have happened. Well, In the first place, that's nonsense. Not that there aren't any cases like that. Of course, there are. But in Dr. Simon's case, what is perfectly clear is that he was trying to push Barney into the position of saying, well, he had just absorbed Betty's dreams, which took place not too long after the original experience, which didn't...
Right, he was playing the devil's advocate in a broad sense.
Yeah, he was. And Barney wasn't buying any of it. And, you know, here we have a case of a hypnotist, a world-class psychiatrist, you understand, but a hypnotist who was, if anything, pushing people away from an abduction viewpoint entirely. So that's one of the important things, that Kathleen has done a comparative analysis of what Betty said, of what Barney said, of what Simon was trying to get Barney to say. Another important part of the book deals with the star map work, because the original book had Betty's drawing made as a post-hypnotic suggestion from Dr. Simon of what she says she saw while she was asking the leader of this alien crew where he was from. And in the understatement of the month, she told him, I know you're not from around here. And he showed her, well, okay. He showed her what I can only call a three-dimensional model or map, probably a hologram, but we didn't have the word back then. You know, she's looking up at it, and she says, well, where are you on the map? And clever alien says, well, do you know where you are on the map? No. Well, how can I tell you where I'm from if you don't know where you're at? Betty didn't know anything about astronomy. Not surprisingly, she was a social worker. Barney was active in civil rights activities. This wasn't the science world. And contrary to the popular mythology, and somebody tried to foist this off on me two nights ago, oh, Barney just saw a science fiction program. They didn't watch science fiction. They didn't watch the program that the noisy negativists have dredged up to say, well, they must have just heard that program. It's nonsense that that's what happened. So, anyway, Dr. Simon, and you can imagine how he felt. He's got two obviously sensible people, and I should stress, I met both Betty and Barney back in 1968. And have seen Betty many times since, and Barney died 3 months later, incidentally, having nothing to do with meeting me, of course. And Betty, Dr. Simon, he's got these two very sensible people, and he gives Betty a post-hypnotic suggestion to draw this map later on, if and only if you can remember it accurately. And she does that, and it's in the book, and it's a big mystery. You got 16 points, which supposedly stand for stars, and you got heavy trade routes, light trade routes, and occasional expedition, the leader explains to Betty. And the map is in the book, but how are you going to find out what it means? I mean, you know, we've got a galaxy that's got 200 billion stars in it. Well, obviously, it doesn't have all the stars in the galaxy, but even our local neighborhood has got... within 55 light years back then, we thought there were about 1,000 stars. Now we think there are 2,000 because we can detect much smaller stars than were detectable back then. Instrumentation has greatly improved. But even if there are only 1,000, only 46 of them are similar to the sun. And I better stress, sun-like stars means not too hot, not too cold, not too old, not too new, not too close to another star, not too variable in their energy output, alternately freezing and frying is not a good way for life to develop, apparently. And so what does it mean? It seemed hopeless at the time the book came out. Well, I got a call a few years later from the head of the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, a woman named Coral Lorenzen. APRO was one of the two major UFO groups in the States back then, asking if maybe I could help a woman named Marjorie Fish, who was working on the Hill star map. She had visited Betty, and she came up with a unique approach. She was a third-grade school teacher, but she was a member of Mensa, the high IQ organization, certainly one of the most objective people I'd ever met. Anyway, she was building three-dimensional models of our local neighborhood to see if she could find a three-dimensional pattern that matched the two-dimensional one that Betty had drawn, flat piece of paper, you know. And so I said yes, and I was intrigued, and Marjorie sent me a whole bunch of handwritten material, and I managed to meet her. I was traveling all over the place, a little younger then, so I gave more talks per year than I do now. But I've stopped to see her, examined some of her models. helped discuss her work with Dr. J. Allen Hynek at a planetarium in Chicago, helped at a Mutual UFO Network symposium in Akron, Ohio, and published the first article in the long gone, Saga magazine. And I also instigated the work by Terence Dickinson, editor of the very respectable Astronomy magazine. His article about her work, and he talked to a lot of people, verified that it was accurate and carefully done and so forth, got more response than anything the magazine had ever published before or since. They published about 11 letters over the next year or so, including a couple from my University of Chicago classmate for 3 years, Carl Sagan. And he never bragged about me being his classmate, so I can brag about him being mine. He's not around to complain about that. We were the same age, grew up in adjacent towns in New Jersey, as a matter of fact. Anyway, it was incredible, the response that it got. And I talked to Terry Dickinson, who wrote the article, 6 months ago. And we both agreed it's remarkable how well Marjorie's work had stood the test of time. Now, the key feature here, if people are trying to envision this, what she did was take beads and string them on nylon cord in a big wooden frame and get the cord in the right three-dimensional location. And the whole point would be to look at it from all different directions to see if there was a three-dimensional pattern that matched the two-dimensional one that Betty had drawn. It's a quite remarkable piece of work. She built a total of 26 different three-dimensional models. And it was the problem that she had was getting good distance data. You see, the astronomers weren't planning on going anywhere, so it didn't matter how far away stars in the local neighborhood were. You'd aim at a certain angle where you needed two angles. You didn't need the distance. It didn't matter if it was 20 light years away or 30 light years away. You were still looking at the right star. However, if you're going to build a 3D model, you need to know the distances. It was only after a new catalog of distances to nearby stars came out by Wilhelm Gliese that Marjorie found one and only one pattern that matched. It was a big day. And
I can imagine.
Well, she's not a very emotional person, but she was certainly pleased that day, let's put it that way. And what this did was enable us to identify all the stars in the pattern. And it turns out, most remarkably, and not known before this work was done, that A, all the pattern stars are the right kind for planets and life. They're sun-like stars, in other words. That's 16, and only 5% of the stars in the neighborhood are the right kind, but all the right kind in that three-dimensional volume of space are part of the pattern, and all the pattern stars are the right kind. Chance of that being an accident. Just coincidence, you know, like 1 in 10,000. Some say 1 in a million, but being a very conservative guy like me, I say 1 in 10,000.
I wouldn't have taken you for a conservative guy.
Well, I'm making a joke. What the heck? Well, I am conservative. I'm a nuclear physicist who studied a heck of a lot of evidence, and you don't find my sticking my neck out until I'm pretty darn sure of what I'm saying. I have a very big gray basket, not black, not white, maybe. But in this case, what's really exciting is that the base stars in this pattern, two stars that were close to each other with very heavy trade routes between them, turn out to be Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli. That's the constellation of Reticulum. That means the net in Latin. You can't see them from here. You've got to go below the equator. And now consider the situation. The nearest other star to the sun is like 4.3 light years away. These two stars from the sun are about 39.3 light years. That's just down the street. I mean, the galaxy is 100,000 light years across, so it's next door. But more intriguingly, the two stars from each other are only an eighth of a light year apart, which means they're 35 times closer to each other than the sun is to the next star over. We're out in the boondocks. They got next-door neighbors. And, oh, one additional little point. Those two stars are a cool billion years older than the sun. One would expect, using Friedman's law, that technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. that the guys out there, guys and gals, probably know some things that we don't know. I mean, just look back 100 years and see how much things have changed, you know. So you don't need a billion. Maybe they're only 1,000 years ahead of us. That's good enough. So that work, none of that, of course, had appeared in the original book, and none has really appeared in a book since then. So this book gives people a chance to look at that. I also dealt with the criticism of Marjorie's work. It's amazing how the people who attacked her work, every single one, misrepresented what she did in her work, which I find quite remarkable. Well, it isn't. Friedman's rules, again, I made them up, for debunkers are what the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. If you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's easier. And don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. And do your research by proclamation. Investigation is too much trouble. You know, it might take some time and effort. So Captured has done well. It's had excellent reviews. Kathleen was trained in sociology and education, sort of an unusual combination with a nuclear physicist. But she was also active, and a lot of people don't realize this, with the Mutual UFO Network for 10 years. She handled the certification of field investigators.
Did she become active because of her aunt's story and aunt's experience?
Well, in a way. I mean, she knew about the beginning part of the experience the day after it happened because Betty called Kathleen's mother, Betty's younger sister, the next day. And Kathleen was there. She was a teenager at the time. And so she heard about it then. They visited Betty and Barney not too long thereafter. Kathleen saw the strange shiny marks on the car. A lot of things that she was well aware of right from the beginning. Then there came, I mean, she lived her own life. She's a grandmother. She, for a period of time, was kind of doubtful because some of Betty's attempts at what might be called UFO investigation didn't really match up to reality. She worked too hard at it, so to speak, and jumped to too many conclusions. So the whole point of the exercise is that with Kathleen having almost total access to Betty the last 5-10 years of her life, lived not far away. She is executrix of Betty's estate, for example, and has all the papers. She's preparing everything for the University of New Hampshire archives and stuff like that. So she had a real opportunity to talk about it with Betty. Betty was not a shy person. I mean, she gave you her opinions. She's in my movie, UFOs Are Real, way back then, as is Marjorie Fish, as a matter of fact. And another interesting person, Dr. George Mitchell, an astronomer at Ohio State University who helped Marjorie in her work, and stated on camera how accurate he and his students found those three-dimensional models to be. So,
wow.
I found out I hadn't fully appreciated this because I'd become interested before reading about the Betty and Barney Hill case. I read the first book I read way back in 58, and the publicity about the case was in the mid-60s. But I hadn't realized until both Kathleen and I were signing books at the Mutual UFO Network Symposium in Denver in early August, and there were so many people who said, you know, this is the book that first got me interested in UFOs. And that's probably why the book is doing well, that people had heard about the case but hadn't realized there was a lot more to it than what they heard about when the first book was out.
Okay, let me interrupt you just so that people can be directed to get this material, because I'm sitting here looking at the incredible list of books and statements and papers and videos that you can supply people. So the website is www.stantonfriedman.com.
Better put a so dot after the triple W, .stantonfriedman.com.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even, you're right, www.stantonfriedman.com. And he's got a shopping cart, PayPal, set up so that you can get your hands on some of these incredible documents. We have quite an audience also in Europe. Do you have the PAL version of that video? UFO video?
It's say, no, I don't have any PAL versions. I do have some DVDs, and I'm told most of them are Universal. And there is a special little charge for postage because, for some reason, the American Post Office charges an arm and a leg to send stuff to Europe. The book is available.
Oh, yes, I do know that. I do know that. Okay, so they've got your number, your website information. And I'd like to, because earlier you said that everybody knows the story, and actually not everybody really knows the story of Betty and Bill. And Barney, sorry. So could we just do a really quick overview of what occurred,
what was reported
by these two people?
It was September 19th, 1961. They were coming south from a quick trip, almost unexpected, sort of a delayed honeymoon, coming down from Canada to their home in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which is between Massachusetts and Maine, right on the Atlantic coast. Coming down through the White Mountains, they spotted Betty spotted a UFO, watched it for some time. It was late at night, nobody around, Barney's driving. She tells Barney, he sort of rejects it, Betty, there aren't any UFOs, must be an airplane. Well, look at it, look how it's moving, look at the light. Well, maybe it's a helicopter, Betty, there aren't any UFOs. And they quietly talked about it, and they actually stopped the car three times while they looked at this thing, because it came close and it was behaving in a peculiar fashion, and star step flight pattern, which made no sense because airplanes can't do that. And there were some strange noises. I mean, Barney got out of the car looking with binoculars to try to figure out what gives with this thing. And he saw beings behind the windows on this round object, which was just a few hundred feet away, sitting in the sky silently. And he suddenly gets terrified because he's getting a thought from the guy on board the craft. And he dashes back to the car, and they take off. And to make a long story short, eventually they stopped. And I was at the actual location where this happened. It's out in the middle of nowhere, practically, in Lincoln, New Hampshire. And it's clear the only way Barney would have gone off the main road onto a secondary road and then onto a tertiary road was if somebody was controlling his actions, because he would never have done that. And that's an important part of this whole story, is that the aliens seemed to control Betty and Barney, this turns up in loads of abduction cases, without putting a gun to their head or a knife to their throat, you know, the standard Earthling approach to this kind of thing. But apparently, I'll call it telepathically, I don't know what the right term to use.
Well, we could probably say mind control, huh?
Yeah, mind control. And incidentally, think about that for a minute. Wouldn't every government love to be able to control the soldiers of their enemies, let's say? Put your guns down.
Yeah, I might even say they already know how to do it. Oh, yes.
Yeah, so it's one. There are many reasons for the government cover-up, but certainly one is to be able to figure out the technology of the aliens, not just, you know, faster craft and more maneuverable craft and silent flight and all that sort of stuff, but also this mind-to-mind kind of stuff, which is really scary. And so they were taken on board, examined in separate rooms, stick a little needle here, scrape a little skin there, clip a little hair there. There were some curious moments, like when they come into the room that Betty's in, they were in separate rooms, and they start pulling at her teeth, the investigators. And she's asking, you know, what is this? What's this all about? They couldn't understand why Barney's teeth came out. He had dentures. And Betty's didn't. I mean, you know, a nice little touch there. And I've had somebody say, well, if they were coming here from someplace a long ways away, surely they would know about dentures. And I have to ask
dentures.
Why. You know? Everybody knows about dentures. Of course they don't. You know, there's a new experience all over the place. And
I was, in reading the book, I was struck by the fact that Betty seemed to have a good camaraderie with the commander.
Yeah.
I think she asked him if she could take back a map. Well, what was it? I don't remember.
Well,
now.
Yeah, she did.
She asked him if she could take something back as evidence.
Yeah, as proof.
And he was giving her something, and the others in the crew made him stop doing that. Is that correct?
Well, yes, in the sense that she saw something. He asked, you know, what would you like? And she grabs what I can only describe as a book. It was not in English language or anything like that, but there seemed to be columns of symbols there. So she has that, and she's holding it. It was only a little while later, when they were about to be put back out, that the leader told her that they had decided that they wouldn't remember what happened and took back the book. To much to Betty's distress, "I will too remember," she said. Well, she got the last laugh on that one, I guess. But, yeah, so we don't have a souvenir. Now, you know, I'm the original civilian investigator of the Roswell incident, so I know we have pieces and parts and all that sort of stuff, but abduction cases don't seem to have people bringing back souvenirs. No his and her towels, you know, no matchbooks, no T-shirts, no mugs, whatever. And, you know, that's part of this picture of control. And, you know, we take for granted that people are all different. You know, sensitivity to drugs, for example, just our genetics are different, all that sort of thing. Well, it may be that aliens take a little learning about why some people react this way and other people react that way. And, you know, it's not an easy chore to go kidnapping earthlings and examining them and putting them back out, especially if you want to be kind to dumb animals, which is kind of the way I describe how they treat us. Well, you know, look, we sedate polar bears and attach a little device that sends signals to a satellite, which sends signals back to a researcher so he can figure out where the polar bear is. Now, what do you suppose that polar bear tells to his friends when he goes home for lunch? "Well, I saw these crazy-looking characters, and they did something, you know."
Well, you know, it's interesting that you would make that comment because, in fact, I've just given a workshop here in Amsterdam, which is why I'm here. And, by the way, that's an occasion for me to say hello to my family in Holland. Thank you for listening in. And we were talking about how it will be when we have global contact and, you know, the concept of dark and light aliens as no different than dark and light human beings. And, of course, we don't really think too much about the torture that we put animals through to do our tests. And yet the idea that alien beings would study us in the same way is beyond horrific. I think that's a very big statement about our consciousness.
There's an ego problem here. We've gone down. Remember that Copernicus's book, in which he foolishly expounded the notion that the Earth is not the center of the universe, the sun is. That's one little step over. The book was banned by the church for 300 years. We must be on top of the heap. Well, okay, then we got to the point where, gee, you know what? The sun isn't the middle of the universe either. Or maybe it's the middle of the galaxy. Now we know that isn't true, and our galaxy isn't the middle of the universe. And so we've come down off the peak, so to speak, and there's another very important part of this. We, back in Copernicus's time, Bishop Usher had come to the conclusion, he went through the Bible carefully, how many generations and who begat who and how old who was and whatever, and concluded that the earth was created on, I think it was October 23rd, 4004 B.C. So roughly 6,000 years ago, so no big deal. We know much about the universe. We haven't missed much. Well, now with radioactive dating and a whole bunch of other physics kind of related stuff, we know that our planet's maybe 4.5 billion years old. The galaxy is at least 13 billion years old. And suddenly we realize that, you know what, there could be advanced civilizations out there all over the place about which we have known nothing. That bothers some people. We want to be on top of the heap. It's part of the difference between ufology and the SETI movement, you know, about SETI, effort to well, I call it silly effort to investigate, you know. We presume that...
I like that.
Well, we presume that there are aliens out there who are sending us signals, that, and we can figure out just what kind of communication systems they have and interpret those signals. They're trying to attract our attention, and they're going to tell us all the secrets of the universe. And my view is that we know so little about what's going on outside our own place here that we're much more like the gorillas in a nature preserve in Africa who know nothing at all about what's going on outside the preserve. And, you know, our egos, again, are in for a beating here. Now, part of that goes with that is the whole question of power. And on my website, www.santenfriedman.com, I have a paper called The UFO Why Questions, W-H-Y, in which, you know, I get into the questions of why would governments cover up this, as they certainly are. And in my lectures, I mean, holding it close to the phone, you still won't be able to see the blacked out and whited out documents from the government that we get under freedom of information. You know, one line per page you can read and the rest is whited out or blacked out.
Freedom very of helpful. Information.
Very helpful. But when you look at this stuff, this whole question of what's going on, and I get people asking me, well, why would aliens come here? A couple versions of that. Why would they come this long way through these huge distances? And I don't consider 39 light years a huge distance, not when Andromeda's 2 million light years out there. You know, why would they come all this way and crash in New Mexico? That's a dumb Well, it's a dumb question because every indication is that the little craft don't do the travel between the stars. The heavy lifting is done by the motherships, which people see. We've got a lot of good cases of craft being, let's say, a half a mile to a mile long, which the direct analogy here, I think, that makes this easy to understand. The United States Navy has nuclear aircraft, nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. They're huge, about 1,200 feet long. And they can go without refueling for 18 years. Now, they carry, well, it's pretty neat. I'm a nuclear guy, and I take great pride in the way they've arranged that.
18 years?
Well, yeah. They have burnable poisons, they're called, materials that absorb neutrons, and these get used up at about the same rate as the fuel gets used up. So it keeps grinding away and grinding away. It's real neat. But compare that to the 75 small airplanes. They're certainly small by comparison to the carrier. And they can go, what, 3 hours without refueling? If they're going at very high speed, maybe 2 hours, you know. So,
right.
In other words, the small craft aren't just coming here from Zeta Reticuli. They're passengers on a big space carrier. The second question, why would they come here? Now, in my why questions, I give about 20 reasons for coming to planet Earth. You know, weekly broadcast idiocy in the boondocks on the radio stations out there. It's the honeymoon capital this corner of the galaxy. Your gas food lodging next exit. You can think.
I thought you were going to say McDonald's.
Well,
all
no,
you can eat.
No, space burgers. How's that? No, but, you know, we sometimes forget how many different reasons are there for people to travel long distances. And especially Americans, you'd think they'd remember the 49ers, 1849. Thousands of people went west, out in the middle of nowhere. Why? Because gold was discovered. Why did they go up to Alaska at the end of the 19th century? Gold was discovered. It turns out the Earth is the densest planet in the solar system. I don't mean the people. Probably true, too. But it's a cubic foot of Earth, cubic meter, weighs more than a cubic meter of any other planet in the solar system. You say, who cares? Well, that means there are more heavy metals. I mean,
right.
Things like, not like lead, which is only 11 times denser than water, but like tungsten and uranium and gold and rhenium and osmium, which are close to, well, 19 to 22 times denser than water. And many of these metals have very special properties, which we didn't know a darn thing about. If you go back 100 years, you know what the major use for uranium was? It was a glaze on yellow pottery. That's not what it's being used for today. You get my point, that they may be coming after stuff that we place no value on. There are many reports of UFOs coming up out of the ocean. Maybe they're picking up the nodules that are down there of pure metals. Who knows? Maybe they're mining the asteroids. But I think
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just wanted to ask you, while you're on that subject, can you speak to the reports that crafts have been seen hovering over a lake and emptying out a lake or just sucking up untold quantities of water?
Well, there are reports like that, not only of pulling in water, and we are the only planet in the solar system that's richly covered with water, a lot of it. I don't mean there hasn't been water other places. I'm just saying if you look at the total picture, we got a lot of oceans out there. Three-quarters of the planet's covered with it, and some of it's pretty deep, the miles kind of thing. There are reports of them sucking up water from lakes. That's fresh water. There are reports of them going beneath the ocean and coming back up out of it, unidentified submerged objects, USOs. And if these things work similar to the electromagnetic submarine, which takes advantage of the fact that seawater, not freshwater, but seawater, is a good electrical conductor, it turns out you can solve all the problems of high-speed flight if you ionize the air, make it an electrically conducting fluid. Like what happens when a meteor comes in, what you see isn't the meteor, it's the glow around it because it's ionized the air, broken up the atoms. You can solve all the problems of high-speed flight, control lift, drag, heating, sonic boom production, radar profile, all these things. Well, the seawater is another electrically conducting fluid, so, you know, that may be a part of the whole picture here. But when it comes to why come here at this particular time, we've seen there were plenty of sightings. You go back to the Bible and, what's his name, Dr. Barry Downing's book, The Bible and Flying Saucers. He goes back Old and New Testament and finds a lot of saucer events. They didn't have saucers or weren't called that, of course, but she looked like shields, you know, stuff like that. But if you go back and think about it for a minute, I think that one major reason for coming here is because we are threatening to be able to go out there, horrible thought as that must be to our alien neighbors. I mean, there were three events at the end of World War II that would have told any smart alien that soon these idiots on Earth, this primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare, which unfortunately I think is a pretty good description of bad stuff, but I think it's accurate. Soon these guys are going to be bothering us, soon meaning 100 years, which is nothing on a cosmic timescale. The three things were nuclear weapons, which leave their signs in the atmosphere in a few places on the planet. This is right after the war now, I'm thinking. Where things are very highly radioactive, easily measured. Second thing is the use of rockets, and certainly everybody knows that the V-1 and V-2 rockets that were being fired from Germany to England were not being used to carry the mail. They were being used to destroy. And third was the development of, I'll call it electronics, sort of primitive, but radar, powerful radar, which was one of the great secrets of the Second World War, that the Germans didn't know that the English had developed it. I have to tell you a funny little story. German general heard that the English were building these 200-foot-tall towers with cross members on them. And he figured that, hey, we're working on radar in secret. This is 1938, before the war started. And that must be that's what the Brits are doing. So we got to figure out what frequencies they're using, what characteristics of the radar are, and so forth. So they sent the Graf Zeppelin, all 700-plus feet of it, flying along slowly. These towers were right alongside the English Channel, heading faced toward Europe, if you will. They sent the Graf Zeppelin along at 70 miles an hour, and were listening. They got all kinds of gear on board the Graf. They didn't find anything. No signals. Now, the Brits did pick up all this craft moving along. The Germans tried it a second time, and they still didn't hear anything electromagnetic wave-wise, and so they presumed the Brits didn't have radar. Well, as it turns out, the Brits did, except they were using a frequency for their radar that was 10 times greater than what the Germans were using. Well, if the Germans couldn't figure out what the British would use, considering how close the civilizations are, not just geographically, but, you know, psychologically, if you will, the scientists on both sides of the English Channel certainly were aware of the other guys. They published in the same journals. They went to some of the same schools. How in the world would a SETI guy figure out what somebody else is going to be using out there? But
yeah.
Anyway, the electronics, you put all those three things together, nuclear weapons, rockets, and powerful electronics. There was only one place in the world in July 1947 where you could study all three of those, and that was southeastern New Mexico. That's where the first atom bomb was tested, Trinity Site, White Sands Missile Range. That's where we're firing all the captured German V-2s. Whole car, a trainload of them. And that's where we had our best radar to track the rockets, which unfortunately didn't always go where they were supposed to go. Some even went south to Mexico instead of north in Mexico.
And that's where Roswell is, right?
Oh, you got it. You got there. That's, mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, when I said this on English television one time, there was an English astronomer there and very haughtily said, well, they could have gone to the Soviet Union. And I had to say, no, the Russians didn't test their first A-bomb until August 1949. You know, why let the facts get in the way of a good debunking attempt, you know? So what I'm suggesting is I think it is perfectly natural for every society to want to be concerned about its own security. You know, doesn't everybody we know want that? And I think that means you got to keep tabs on the primitives in the neighborhood, but only close tabs on those primitives who show signs of being able to bother you. And
right.
This seems perfectly rational behavior, that you don't wait until the idiots are out there marauding. You keep tabs on them, and when they get ready to go, you say, no, you guys don't qualify for membership in the Galactic Federation. You know, a simple question. Well, who speaks for planet Earth? And I get Americans saying, I mean, I'm an American and a Canadian, so I can complain about both governments, as a matter of fact. But Americans will say, well, why don't they land on the White House lawn? As if the President of the United States speaks for planet Earth. 6 billion Earthlings, there are 300 million Americans. He has trouble speaking for all of them much of the time. He certainly doesn't speak for the whole planet. You know, besides which, incidentally, there were loads of sightings over the White House back in 1952, the biggest year in Project Blue Book's history. And there's a brand new book, Shoot Them Down, by Frank Fascino, Jr., just came out last month, for which I wrote the foreword and the epilogue. Which comes
I'm sorry,
over
can you rename that book? I didn't hear you.
The name of the book is Shoot Them Down.
Uh-huh, okay.
And that title, it may sound peculiar until you realize that military pilots were issued orders in the summer of 52 to shoot down UFOs if they didn't land when instructed to do so. And one Air Force general publicly stated, we scrambled jets after UFOs hundreds of times. And we have proof of this. I mean, the head of the American Rocket Society, as a matter of fact, a guy named Farnsworth, sent a letter to President Truman saying he didn't think that was a good policy. And I tend to agree with him. But what I'm suggesting is that when the aliens did try to land on the White House lawn, we weren't very friendly about it. But
neither will we be in the future, I imagine.
Well, you know, it's a strange world. We all are concerned about survival and security, and there isn't anybody who speaks for the planet. And, you know, we Americans, that side of me anyway, say that, hey, we believe in freedom and democracy and elections, and then when you try to figure out how are we going to select who speaks for planet Earth, it sure isn't going to be an election, because China's got 1.3 billion people, India's got a billion people, the United States only has 300 million. We're not going to give one vote, you know, one person one vote under those conditions. At least I don't
imagine.
Or let's
say we hope not.
No, and so this subject takes a lot of thinking. And one thing, I have another paper on my website that is Government UFO Lies. I know it comes as a shock to your audience, but there have been occasions when the government has lied about UFOs.
No.
Yeah, and I don't discriminate. I have lies from the CIA and the FBI and the Air Force and the NSA. They've all been lying all over the place. And so you have to ask, if there's nothing to this subject, why are you doing all the lying about it? And some of those lies are even about me, and I resent that, frankly. In the two government reports about Roswell, there are numerous lies about me and about Major Jesse Marcel. And incidentally, there's another new book for which I wrote the foreword, Dr. Colonel Jesse Marcel Jr., has a new book, The Roswell Legacy. He handled wreckage at the age of 11. His father is the first military guy who was on site with, out in the debris field, out in the middle of nowhere in New Mexico. And Jesse, I'm a great admirer. He's 71 now. He was called back in to serve in the Army Air Force in Iraq at age 68. He's a flight surgeon, a helicopter pilot, a colonel, and so he spent a full year over there. He knew of one guy who was older than he was. I've seen him recently at a couple of conferences, and I wrote the foreword for his book. But Roswell happened. We're still looking for more witnesses, but of course we're losing all those races to the Undertaker out there. But I mention this only because I get sick and tired of people saying, there is no evidence, it was just a mogul balloon. And if you,
yeah,
look if you look carefully at the characteristics of moguls, what they're made out of, how much material is involved, when they were flown, et cetera, they don't fit. And if they don't fit, you must acquit. Nothing matches.
Right.
I get a little sick of the knee-jerk reactions from the nasty, noisy negativists about Roswell.
I love that description.
Well,
the noisy negativists, that's good.
Well, nasty. You got to throw that in, too. Remember,
I
didn't
get it. I heard another description recently of, I think it was the Phoenix Lights, as being Thai candles, floating candles in the air.
Now that
I
hadn't heard
that
before. I've talked
Thai
to witnesses. I've talked to witnesses to the Phoenix Lights, and you know, part of the problem is that, as usual, the media got confused. There were sightings of flares at 10 o'clock. The important sighting was at between 8:15 and 8:30 of this huge triangular-shaped thing, maybe half mile to a mile long, that blotted out the sky. There were a lot of people out looking for the Hale-Bopp comet that night, and a beautiful clear night, March 13th, 1997, in Phoenix, which has a mild climate. It was 95 degrees there, for, I guess.
Yeah,
And I've talked to a number of witnesses, and Dr. Bruce Maccabee, an optical physicist, has analyzed the film of the later event, and that was way the heck out there, and it wasn't the Phoenix Lights at all. And as a matter of fact, I had a chance to talk to the former governor of Arizona, a man named Fife Symington, in 1997. He actually had a press conference when people were making a fuss about the Phoenix Lights, and he had one of his assistants dress up as an alien to poke fun at the whole business. Well, earlier this year, he came forward and admitted that he had seen the lights, and he had been a pilot, still is flying, as a matter of fact. I had a chance to talk to him. We were both on the Larry King Show on July 13th, and three reruns of the show for some reason. And, you know, here's a guy who was a pilot, and he saw the early lights. So, you know, it was a very good case that was botched by the press and even some of the ufologists who wanted to try to make the 10 o'clock lights until the 8:15 lights. And, you know, it's almost like time travel for the crash test dummies. I love that explanation by the Air Force for Roswell. Well, you know, when I say time travel, we're not talking an hour and a half. We're talking about 6 years. Now, you know what's really crazy is that the Air Force got away with that really stupid explanation. Well, people's memories were confused. 6 years. off, and they got away with it. The New York Times bought it, didn't object. And there's another problem with the crash test dummies, incidentally. just a little problem. I talked to the guy who was head of the program, and he pointed out to me, and I met with him in person now. This wasn't third hand. He pointed out that the crash test dummies, for the test to be meaningful, they were looking at ejection seats and that sort of thing. You don't want to use people the first few times around because the systems might not work. He said the dummies, and I have pictures of them, were 6 feet tall and weighed 175 pounds to match pilots. Otherwise, the test would be meaningless. Well, there's no way you can morph somebody that looks like that down into a 4 foot tall guy with a big head and a skinny body. Well, you know, it just doesn't compute.
So that would be a lot of compacting on crash.
Yeah, it really would be. And so I mean, that's typical of the lie.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like the notion that Jesse Marcel, who'd had a course in radar that involved the use of radar reflectors, couldn't recognize a balloon. And that Colonel Blanchard, the head of the 509th, the most elite military group in the world, the group based at Roswell, that he couldn't recognize a weather balloon. A dumb, old, conventional weather balloon. Now, a lot of the television programs have shown this huge polyethylene teardrop-shaped balloon. That's malarkey. None of those were used for Mogul at that time. So I try to replace the myths with reality. And, yeah, I may be a little nasty toward the noisy negativists, but they deserve every bit of it. As far as I'm concerned, anyway.
Well, plus, I mean, the thing about Roswell that always stands out in my mind is the fact that the military first came out and made the statement that there had been what appeared to be a UFO crash.
Flying saucer. They didn't use the word UFO. They said flying saucer.
Flying saucer, okay.
Flying
and then retracted
disc.
Retracted it the next day and came up with the story with the balloons.
That was the first two explanations. Then we had the third one, which was the Mogul balloon explanation. This was in 1994. And then we had the crash test dummies in 97. I'm waiting for explanation number five.
Could you insert the tie balloons? Or that? No, that wouldn't work here.
The what kind of balloons?
The tie candle balloons
oh,
to go up.
Well, they haven't suggested it yet, but why not? Hey, if you can time travel... you know, crash test dummies, why not to tie balloons, you know?
Let me ask you a question. Your history is so fascinating to me, from nuclear physicist to UFO expert, and I'd like to ask you, pick your brain, is how did you make this journey into
well, I started off perfectly innocently. I was ordering books from a mail-order house in New York. I was a young nuclear physicist working for General Electric on nuclear airplanes. It was a big program. We were spending $100 million a year in 1958, 3,500 people employed full-time, 1,100 of them engineers and scientists. This wasn't a little study group, in other words. Anyway, I was ordering books, and I needed one more book so I wouldn't have to pay shipping. And because I'm a cheapskate, here was the report on unidentified flying objects by Air Force Captain Edward J. Ruppelt, who had headed Project Blue Book in the early 50s. This was 58.
Wow.
The book was marked down from $2.95 to $1, and it wasn't going to cost me anything because shipping would have been $1. And I figured, heck, the Air Force was co-sponsoring our program. I didn't think badly of the Air Force at that time. And this guy ought to know what he's talking about. And besides, it ought to be worth a laugh, and it's not costing me anything. Anyway, I read the book, shared it with an engineer next door. Charlie was 10 years older than I was, and he was more impressed than I was with the book, which turned out to be a very fortunate early choice. Moved to California, had a good librarian, read 15 more books, and then discovered the real shocker, Project Blue Book Special Report Number 14, biggest study ever done for the Air Force, and not mentioned in any of the 15 books I'd already read. And that one shook me up. This was a privately published version at the University of California.
And how'd you get your hands on that?
It was in the library at the University of California, Berkeley. Somebody had put it there.
Wow.
And so I read it, and I read the press release, which the guy had included, and look, I was working under security. I expect you sometimes bend the truth a little bit because of security. But here was the Secretary of the Air Force, Donald Quarles, lying through his teeth in the press release. He said, on the basis of this report, we believe that no objects such as those properly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. Even the unknown 3% could have been identified as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been available. That sounds pretty straightforward until you look at the data. And I'm a data hound. It turns out 21.5% of the sightings couldn't be explained, completely separate from the 9.5% for which there was insufficient information. They did a quality evaluation. They found the better the quality, the more likely to be unexplainable. They did a cross-comparison between the unknowns, which are the only ones we're interested in, and the knowns, and they found the probability that the unknowns were just misknowns was less than 1%. Now, the press release didn't say who did the work, where it was done, or even give the proper title, Blue Book Special Report 14, because surely some reporter would have said, hey, what happened to 1 through 13? And the answer would have to have been, had it been honest, that they were all classified at that time. But so that book shook me up, and I joined APRO and NICAP, and I got to know Frank Edwards, who had a best-selling book, Flying Saucers, Serious Business. He sent me a copy of the book, and when I moved to Pittsburgh to work for Westinghouse, after a few more canceled programs, I have a history of working on canceled programs, and I asked Frank for any suggestions. I want to go public, Frank. He gave me some names, and I called the big radio station in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, KDKA, one of the first big stations. And there was a talk show, and they, you know, don't call us, we'll call you. Well, about a month later, they called me. Somebody had canceled. It was 6:30. The program was on at 7. They knew I lived not far from the station. Could you come on tonight, please? And I did. And somebody at work heard me on the radio, a technician at Westinghouse Astronuclear Lab. Their book, her book review club, was reading Frank's book. Could I speak to them? That was my first lecture in somebody's living room. And then I did the radio show a number of times, and the real breakthrough was I was asked to speak at the Engineering Society of Detroit. And would you believe we had 1,000 people? They were sold out for 1,008 people for dinner and a talk 2 weeks in advance. And there wasn't one negative question. And so I did a whole bunch of these technical groups, and the response was great from people I had to admire. They were older than I was, professional people. And when the bottom fell out of the advanced nuclear and space systems business, I went full-time lecturing. And it's because of the enthusiastic response of my professional colleagues, not the crazy groups. And that's why I stress the 600 colleges. And I've talked to half a dozen sections of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, not only Detroit Engineering Society of Detroit, but Cincinnati Engineering Society, Baltimore Engineering Society, sections of the American Nuclear Society. And I was testing myself, in other words. And we always have a question and answer period. And some idea of the wide acceptance of the reality about flying saucers can be gotten from the fact that I've had 11 hecklers in over 700 lectures, and two of them were drunk. And the audience took care of the other nine. And I come on very, very strong. I am not an apologist ufologist. I'm not a closet ufologist. I tell it like it is.
You do indeed. I have to interrupt you because we've run out of time. Would you believe this?
Yeah, I can believe it.
It's just, would you come back?
Well, sure,
back
why
on?
Not? Why not?
You are amazing. I'm going to rush to your site and fill myself up with, let's see what I've got here, the video, the information on Roswell, the book, which I highly recommend, captured the Betty and Barney Hill experience. And I just got to have you on as soon as possible again. So I didn't even have a chance to invite people to call in for questions because I could not bear to interrupt you. So, but
you
I
mean
have
because
to
I'm
now,
a big mouth?
Because you're amazing and you're just I've never heard anybody be able to share data with such precision and so much humor as well.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I'm delighted. So please come back soon. I'll be in touch with you.
Okay.
And to all of the listeners, the name, the address again is, the URL,
StantonFriedman.com.
Yep.
Stanton, it's been one of the best hours of my life.
Well, thank you so much, Patrick.
Thank you. I will hope to have you back soon. Good night, everybody. Thank you for listening to Beyond the Matrix, and we've certainly gone beyond tonight. Thank you, and good night.